So as Ed said, what we're thinking is sort of how do we establish some sort of a consistent system to help guide us in scenarios where we don't necessarily have guidance, where we're trying to establish charitability, but we are a little bit out in the weeds. And we don't certainly want to create a system that would hinder charitable organizations from being able to do innovative work and sort of achieve their charitable goals using new methods. We just want to make sure that we protect them while they're doing that and make sure that we sort of ground them in sort of the basics of charitability to make sure that, you know, in the event of, for example, an audit, they would have some sort of a consistent methodology to point back to say, here's how we decided that this works. We use this system. We sort of tie things back to established sort of markers of charitability, and that's how we got from A to X. So in terms of just going sort of back to the basics that's sort of underpinning all of this, so if you're working as a 501c3 organization, you are sort of constrained is maybe the wrong word, but you're working within a chair, a sort of a 501c3 a box. And what is that box? What does it look like? So you have to meet the organizational and operational tests, right? You have to be organized and operated exclusively for charitable purposes. You can't let any of your net earnings inure to private individuals or shareholders. No substantial part of your activities can include lobbying, and you can't participate in political campaign activities. So this is sort of the basic kind of fence that's drawn around what you can do as a C3. So to go a little deeper into that first prong, so the organizational test, your operating documents, your governing documents, have to limit your purposes to exempt purposes, and they can't expressly, you know, give you the ability to participate more than insubstantially in something that's not an exempt purpose. For the operational test, it's how do you carry out those purposes that are set forth in your documentation. So you're going to be deemed to operate exclusively for charitable purposes if you engage primarily in activities that accomplish charitable purposes and, you know, no more than an insubstantial part of your activities further non-exempt purposes. If your net earnings are going to private people, you're going to fail this test. If you're serving private interests and not public interests, you're going to fail this test. So these are sort of the basic boundaries that we're working within. So again, getting back to sort of how we put together a methodology to sort of review the activities that we sort of are interested in participating in or funding, how are we going to approach this question? And we thought sort of the clearest way to do that was to go back and look at those sort of basic boundary areas. So look at whether the activities of the organization are providing a public benefit, and look at whether you're providing that benefit to a charitable class of beneficiaries. And we'll talk a little bit about sort of what a charitable class is. Typically, this is the group of people that you're benefiting by virtue of conducting your activities. So, to the makeup of the class has to be either big enough that you can't individually identify the people who are benefiting, or indefinite enough that sort of the whole community, rather than sort of a set identifiable group of people, is going to benefit as a result of what you're doing. Beyond that, what makes a class charitable is a little gray. It kind of varies a little bit. Generally, guidance indicates that your class has to be disadvantaged or distressed in one way or another. Most typically, that distress or disadvantage will come from financial straits, but not always necessarily. There's a revenue ruling here as an example that talks about an organization that was providing low-cost busing for seniors and for disabled people. And the IRS looked at that and said, even though you're not imposing an income requirement on the people who are using this service, we still think that you're serving a charitable class because you're dealing with a population that has special needs. And to get into sort of what charitable purposes work in terms of what public benefit you're providing. So There in the code and in the Treasury regulations that have been in place for a very long time without really being updated, charitable purposes include relief of the poor and distressed or the underprivileged, advancement of religion, education, science, promotion of social welfare, and the regs call out these sort of four specific ways that you can promote social welfare, lessening the burdens of government, unfortunately only our government, not, for example, the French government. And over time, these things have been expanded, just, you know, by virtue of organizations doing exactly what we're talking about right now, by, you know, pushing the limits a little bit, testing to see whether they can further charitable purposes in ways that are new and different and interesting. And what that's led to is the sort of general acceptance in IRS guidance of charitable purposes that aren't necessarily specifically called out in the code or in the regs. And that includes things like what's on this list here. So revitalizing distressed communities, preservation of cultural heritage, promotion of the arts. These are all areas that aren't necessarily statutorily enshrined, but that are very well accepted as charitable purposes at this point.